This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. They might not ever volunteer any information, but when we take the time to ask a few questions, we learn just how much they've done for us. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. Along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, we're inspired, and we are in for a treat today. Every one of these interviews feels like a privilege for me, but this one is pretty unique. I was invited by Clovis North High School in Clovis, California, to come onto the campus, sit up on stage in the beautiful Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall with legendary conductor Colonel Arnold Gabriel, and in front of a big group of teenagers who are studying music and history, interview this D-Day survivor turned military music icon. You'll find some photos and links to information about Colonel Gabriel at hometownheroesradio.com. If you followed the National Memorial Day Parade in Washington, D.C., maybe you noticed he was the Grand Marshal, fresh off receiving the Air Force Exceptional Service Award at the National Memorial Day Concert, which was held at the Kennedy Center. All this excitement is taking place in 2015, but to start our conversation, we've got to go way back to long before any of those teenagers in our captive audience were born, and long before their parents were born, for that matter.
I know it's a few years ago, but can you take us back to long before you thought about being a colonel or a major or a captain or anything like that, but growing up in central New York? Tell us about your hometown and what life was like before World War II.
Well, it was pretty grim, really. My mom and dad were born in Italy and came to this country with a second-grade education. They got married in Brooklyn, New York, and moved upstate to Cortland, New York. But it was pretty grim because it was during the Depression. And, of course, it was two strikes because not only were everybody in the country was poor because of the Depression in the 30s, but also because I lived in an Italian community, we were discriminated against because we were, quote, foreigners. So it was very difficult. My dad worked on the railroad for 75 cents a day, and I remember my older brother and me and my mom and dad splitting a can of beans for dinner. That's how poor things were in those days.
Now, anyone who knows who you are now or even meets you now, it would be hard for them to see you outside of the realm of music. That's how you're identified in our country and in the world for good reason. But where did that start? How early on did you start to develop this this love for music?
I was about 10 or 11 years old, and my dad loved opera. And right around the corner, there was a Catholic church, and there was a touring company from Syracuse, New York, that was doing Cavalleria Rusticana, the opera. And so I'm a 10, 11-year-old kid, and it was very meager. I think they had a piano and about three woodwinds and about two or three strings, and the sets were very minimal. But when they did the intermezzo from Cavalleria Rusticana, I was taken. To this day, it's my favorite 48 measures of music. And so it was that incident that really hooked me on music and said, I need to be a musician.
All these young people, I mean, we're looking out here at 16, 17, maybe 18-year-olds, and they're looking at you and say, oh, that guy might be 70, 75. Why don't you tell them all how old you are?
90 years old.
How about that? What was your first instrument?
First was a flute.
You did that in high school?
I did.
But something happened while you were going to high school. I think it's important to talk about that because I have not yet met a veteran yet, and I've interviewed hundreds of veterans, who does not have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor?
Precisely. It was a Sunday afternoon. My friend and I went to a movie, and I regret to say this, we went to a pool hall, and it was there we had found out that we were at war with Japan, that they had bombed Pearl Harbor. I remember that very clearly. And I was a boy then of 15 years old in 1941. And I thought, 15 years old, I'm never going to get in. It'll be over long before I get in. And didn't realize that 3 years later, I was going to be in the Army. And 9 months later, I was on the beach of Normandy, landing with the 29th Infantry Division.
Tell me how you ended up in the service. Did you wait until Uncle Sam said, you have to come, you were drafted, or did you decide to enlist before that happened?
No, I enlisted. May 31, I was 18 years old. I graduated high school 2 weeks later, and 6 days later, I enlisted in the Army. So I had just turned 18 and didn't realize a year later, on May 31, I had just turned 19, and 6 days later, I was on the beach of Normandy.
Yeah.
It all happened that fast.
So some of you in here are 18, I'm sure, right? Can you imagine a year from now going ashore on one of the bloodiest beaches that has ever been seen in the history of war? That's what this gentleman experienced. And you didn't just experience being there. A lot of people can say, I was part of the Normandy invasion. The outfit that you were with, the 29th Infantry Division, more specifically the 116th Infantry Regiment,
right,
saw some of the worst of Omaha Beach. Before we get to that, because I think all you guys here, all you students have heard about D-Day, right? You've heard that phrase, D-Day. You've seen some of the pictures. But you don't know what's going to happen before it happens, right? What do you remember about the buildup to that invasion? Were you anticipating something like this? Was this a surprise to you? Can you give us a glimpse of what the weeks or months leading up to D-Day were like?
No, we had planned for an invasion of France. We didn't know precisely where it was going to be, whether it was going to be Calais. Even the Germans were trying to guess where we were going to land. So we had practiced for months about landing on a beach. It was called Slapton Sands in England,
yeah,
which is similar to the beaches of northern France. So we knew that the day would be coming.
Before D-Day, there was a legendary tragedy at Slapton Sands, an Operation Tiger. It was a training exercise, but
right,
the Germans showed up right off the coast in U-boats,
right,
and started gunning down the Americans and the British. You weren't there for that, were you?
That was just north of us. That was the 28th Division from Pennsylvania. And if you knew what the symbol of Pennsylvania is, it's like a bucket. But that's what they wore on their shoulder.
Right.
And it was red. And one of the German subs hit one of the landing craft of the 28th Division. And so from that day forward, we call them the Bloody Bucket Division. But, you know, the kind of gallows humor, you have to keep a sense of humor. We had a guy join us when we were in St. Lo. St. Lo is a city inland. We were supposed to take it D plus 7 days. It was D plus 45. That's how rough it was going inland. And when we finally got there, I was joined with my machine gun squad by a fellow that had been in the 82nd Airborne. And I said, what are you doing here with the 29th Division? He said, well, I don't want to jump anymore because I jumped with my brother on D-Day, and he left his boot on the beach, and his foot was in it. Not funny, but kind of gallows humor that keeps you alive in combat.
Well, and that hits home. And your division, the 29th, was decimated on D-Day. In fact, last year on the 70th anniversary of June 6, 44, you were back at Normandy conducting this huge band on the 70th anniversary. Tell us where you're going to be on the 71st anniversary.
Well, you mentioned the 116th Regiment. A company of the 116th was from, being a National Guard, everybody was from the same city. And A company was from Bedford, Virginia, and they were the spearhead. And on the very first day of D-Day, 24 of them were killed. And before we left Normandy, 44 were killed from that tiny village of Bedford, Virginia. So that's where they built the D-Day Memorial. So on June 6th this year, I'm going to be there. They've asked me to conduct my old division band, the 29th Infantry Division Band, at the D-Day Memorial in Bedford, Virginia. So that'll be very emotional.
That's incredible. And I could tell it's emotional just talking about it for you right here. But for you students, can you imagine that? 24 people from the same hometown on the first day of the invasion, mm-hmm, and 44 throughout that battle. Imagine that 24 people from this room are just gone like that. And they were about your age, mm-hmm, when this happened. So that was part of your division and, in fact, part of your regiment. You were talking about what the Bloody Bucket Division wore on their arms. So you, right, had the blue and gray, right?
The blue and gray, the north and the south. Because it was National Guard from Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. So they were both the North and the South were involved in the National Guard with the 29th Division.
And you were part of a machine gun squad?
Yes, 30 caliber light machine gun.
I know that day is not easy to talk about, and I know that music is something that helped you heal from some of the scars that your whole experience in the war left you with. But what do you remember about that day? It's been called the longest day. It's certainly a,
right,
day that changed the world. But from your perspective, from the time you hit the beach to the end of that day, what are some of the things that you did and experienced?
Well, it was fear, confusion, fright, a little bit of everything. Nobody landed where they were supposed to. Not the 82nd Airborne, who jumped before we hit the beach. We hit the beach way left of where we were supposed to, and I ended up with the 1st Division, which was on our left flank. I was then with the 116th Easy Company, and I said, I've got to get back to the 29th Division. And so total confusion. I didn't have my machine gun because I left that in the water. The water was up to my waist, and most of us either that deep or some have never made it drown before they got to the beach. But anyway, so I made my way back to the 29th and ended up with I Company, the 175th. And they said, we need a machine gunner. You're going to be with us now. I said, well, you better call E Company so they know I'm not dead. So that's what they did. So that whole day was nothing but confusion.
And I want to talk about something you said there. You're going into the water, and you had to leave your machine gun behind. Mm-hmm. Now, this is supposed to be not just your protection, but protection for a whole bunch of your fellow soldiers.
Right.
So now you don't have that. You're coming ashore, and I imagine that there's enemy gunfire and artillery all around you, right?
Exactly. But, you know, there were so many weapons that were dropped by people who did get ashore, who were killed. If you needed a weapon, there it was on the beach because the person who was carrying it was probably killed. And there's another quick fact. In a division, there are 15,000 men, 9,000 of which were combatants, frontline troops. And my son, who's writing my biography, did his homework and discovered that the 29th Infantry Division suffered more casualties in World War II in that 11 months from June 44 till May 45 when the war was over. We had 20,000 casualties. Amazing.
That's a heavy number.
Yeah.
And for you, 19 years old, halfway around the world from home, getting shot at without what you were supposed to have to protect you, what in the world was going through your mind?
Well, like I said, fright, confusion, just you weren't thinking very straight, just to survive.
Now, this may sound like a dumb question, but I'm sure a lot of these young people are wondering themselves about it. Were you scared? Did you think that was it? Did you think you were going to see another day beyond June 6th?
No. I never thought I'd live to be 90, but there was a time when I didn't think I was going to live 10 more minutes. That's what war was like.
I believe it. And we look at now, and I'm just looking at your schedule of all the places around the country that you're going to be sharing your talents musically and thinking of all the lives that you've touched, much less your children and grandchildren. You even have great-grandchildren yet?
I do. I have 13 grandchildren and one great-grandchild.
And none of them would be here if you had been one of those guys from your division who didn't survive past that day.
Yeah.
And just to talk about some of your decorations in the war, and we're going to get to music, and it all ties together, and it's incredible the path that your life has taken. But you're a recipient two times over of the Bronze Star, which isn't easy to get. You earned the Combat Infantry Badge. If you guys ever see a veteran wearing a little blue rectangular badge with a rifle in the middle of it, that's a Combat Infantry Badge. You only earn that by being in combat, as Colonel Gabriel was. I'm sure you're not dying to talk about why you got this or why you got that, but from D-Day, that's just the beginning. I'm sure you had a whole lot of experience from that point on. What are some of the ones that stand out that remind you of how fortunate or blessed you are to still be around?
Well, I joined the 29th Infantry Division in Europe. As I said, they were there in 42. So I was a replacement. I trained in the United States as a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle. When I got to the 29th, they said, no, you're going to be a machine gunner. Oh, really? So they trained me on a machine gun. And what they told me, this was absolutely true fact, that the life expectancy of a 30 caliber light machine gun in combat is 3 days. That's what I had to look forward to. And so when we went ashore on D-Day, like I said, we were supposed to take St. Lô, the first big major city in France, in 7 days, and it was the middle of July, so it was about 45 days before we took St. Lô. And then we went to the port of Brest, and the reason we went there, those of you who are history buffs, know that that's where the submarine bases were that scourged our fleets coming from the United States, troop ships and supply ships. And so by taking Brest, we would have silenced all of those submarines. But what we didn't realize is that they had a 240-millimeter cannon, huge. I mean, it was like a freight train when you heard one of those shells coming overhead. And they were trained, of course, into the ocean. But we didn't know that they turned 180 degrees on us. So that's what we faced in Brest.
I'm sure that giant German gun was a lot louder than that volley from John Philip Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever, but this music you're hearing right now is from a concert on the same stage where we conducted this interview with Colonel Gabriel conducting the Clovis North Wind Ensemble, String Orchestra, Symphony Orchestra, and even the choir from Granite Ridge Intermediate School. There were two concerts, both raising money for Central Valley Honor Flight and the mission of sending World War II veterans to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. We'll hear a little more of the music from those concerts throughout the program today, and we'll hear more of Colonel Gabriel's World War II experience when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.